Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, committee. Senator Chaudhry is in another meeting right now, but I think we'll get started. We have a lot of people on our list today, and we'll try to work through those. So this is the Environment and Natural Resources Committee for the 19th of February. And I will start with our DNR representative to get us started today. I think Kent Loxmo is waiting, and please come to the table and identify yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kent Loxmo, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And thank you for the opportunity to present some background on the on Minnesota Shoreland Program. In your handouts, you have, or in your packet, you have several handouts. Fact sheet's like this. The first was on is just protecting our rivers and lakes, and this gives a background on the Shoreland Management Program. Shoreland management commenced in about 1969 with the passage of the Shoreland Management Act. Following that, there were rules developed, and those were promulgated in 1970. Shoreland rules present a minimum standard, and then counties and local units of government can be more restrictive if they desire. The county enabling statutes, zoning statutes, are in Chapter 394. So shoreland is defined in statutes and in rules. This is dealing with all water basins larger than 25 acres in counties and 10 acres and larger in municipalities. And then the shoreland district includes that land that's within 1,000 feet of the ordinary high water mark of a lake or 300 feet of a river. So with those standards, in 1970, we went through the process of having local governments adopt. At that time, it was just counties. And so by 1973, most counties had adopted those shoreland management controls. There was an issue at that time that counties had controls and the adjacent cities did not. You may have had a lake that was half in, half out, and there were some inherent conflicts like that. So in 1973, the legislature amended the Shoreland Management Act to include municipalities. And then those, the municipal shoreland standards were established in 76, and communities then proceeded to adopt their shoreland management ordinances. That went along until 1983, when there was a shoreland update project. We looked at how things were going and whether or not there were needed changes. That evolved into a rule development process, and a rule was proposed in 1988, and actually that rule was a state-proposed rule. As it hit the street, it garnered lots of concern and some opposition. We then pulled that back, went to a stakeholder process. We had a group of 22 interest groups that then helped shape what was finally adopted into a rule in 1989. The other thing that those 1989 rules did is that combined the municipal and the county standards into one set of standards for the state. So we've been administering under those 1989 rules. The other main thing I think that 1989 rules provided for was flexibility for local governments. The first set of standards was a minimum set statewide. So it had the same set of standards, and as you know, the resource varies significantly from northern Minnesota to southern Minnesota. And so in 1989, we provided the ability for local governments to look at their specific issues and request flexibility and different standards to meet their specific needs. As part of that, then, with this administration, or the last term with the Governor Pawlenty, we initiated the alternative shoreline management standards process to look at, and this was part of the Governor's Clean Water Initiative pilot, looking at the five counties in north central Minnesota. There's a second handout in your packet that's got a map of the state with those counties highlighted: Aiken, Cass, Crow Wing, Hubbard, and Itasca counties. And the first process there in 2004 was to was to survey the members in the counties to see what the issues are. And a couple of the main issues were administration and enforcement of the existing standards, not necessarily changing the standards, but seeing how we could assure consistent administration. This group then met over the course of the next year and a half or so to develop shoreland standards. These are not new shoreland rules. They're alternative standards which the local governments can consider adopting into their own ordinances. So these standards are local tools for the government. And basically what this process evolved, and it was a scientifically built standards, and I believe you're going to hear from Henry Van Offlin and maybe others later on how exactly those some of these standards evolved. But they did look at having different or advanced subdivision controls, having a multiple shoreland classification. So if you have a shallow bay that's far different than the rest of the lake, you could do a different classification on that. And maybe I should back up. The lake classifications that we use are three. General development is for those like a Lake Mille Lacs, a Gull Lake, Lake Minnetonka, lakes that have been larger lakes that were already developed a fair amount in the 1960s. And then natural environments at the other end of the spectrum, which are natural lakes. They're shallower, more vegetated, and very little development. And in between those two is a recreational development class. So as you go from general development, recreational development, natural environment, the lot sizes get bigger, the setbacks get bigger.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lockensmull, could you just further define recreational development? You said it's in between recreational use of the water, or are you thinking of lake homes that are summer cabins? What, could you just clarify that for me?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. It really is just a terminology for that middle class. General development was a heavier developed lake at the time, and recreational development was one that just had a lower level of homes on the lake at the time of classification. But it has nothing to do with the surface use or the type of use on the surface.
Thanks.
The new standards also provide for sensitive area districts, special protection, lake classification for lakes where there's where they are just shallow, and they aren't typically your typical recreational lake that you see, you know, swimming, fishing, boating on. It's also include then improved planned unit development standards, special resort standards. There is an issue for that came up during these discussions about keeping resorts. For the small family resorts that are out there, they currently fall under a planned unit development guidelines. It was very difficult. Most of them have non-conforming structures because they're built too close to the water's edge. And how can they expand to keep up with market trends and those kinds of things? So for the resorts that wish to remain resorts, there are some specific standards in here. There's also some trade-off. If they use that, they should be improving the nearshore area and having some more open space and trying to deal with protection. So that was, if you are able to expand substandard structures and expand them not closer to the lake but further from the lake if they needed to add add space to meet their clientele's demands, they could do that, but also make improvements to address water quality concerns.
Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Loxamo, before you leave this particular topic, this your discussion of it brought back a constituent request of me relative to this whole shoreland management, and it was in regard to Lake Minnetonka and within the city of Minnetrista, went through kind of a battle over density with the Met Council this last spring, and he was looking at the shoreland management ordinances, which, you know, if you look at the amount of space that you're supposed to protect along Lake Minnetonka, if that were at all enforced, there would be no housing, you know, along there to speak of. And so what I'm interested in is, are distinguishing between these classifications, are they in law or are they in standards that the department has written that describe this? Because I see you have a rather clear statement here relative to the improving planned unit development and with the residential densities, increased setbacks, and so on. Are they do you have any authority over the local unit of government that their PUD ordinance has to comply with this, as well as dealing with Met Council when they set their density standards? Are they affected at all by these standards?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, the standards specifically are set in rule, and they are minimum standards that a community or county would have to adopt and meet. They could have more restrictive standards. What's developed in this process of the alternative shoreline standards was a way to make the planned unit development process work better.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lacismo, so are you aware of whether there's any inconsistency between some of Met Council's policies relative to density and this type of thing, as well as within city ordinances? Do you have any oversight there to what those ordinances are and those requirements of Met Council in relation to these standards?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, there is some inconsistency because Met Council is looking certainly in the near, you know, the closer you get to the core cities, Met Council looks for higher density. And with a shoreline district that extends 1,000 feet from the shore, that gets back multiple tiers of development. So there are some inconsistencies there. And what we've looked at is certainly the riparian tier of the first tier of homes around a lake. We need to apply the shoreline standards for the county, the community, I mean. And the community can, under the new 1989 rules, ask for flexibility and come in and argue or discuss the conflict between Met Council's desire for density and the shoreline standards, the minimum state shoreline standards. And then if they can present a credible argument that makes sense, we can approve those changes under the flexibility provisions in the rules.
And so, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lacismo, then I move over to the city of Spring Park, where you have on the north shore of Minnetonka a essentially paved over public access parking, and right across from that are three new huge condominium structures, four stories high. They're all within that 1,000 feet, and there's virtually no uncovered surface. Does that get approval from you, or this flexibility? I'm trying to find whether these standards have any meaning at all, or whether they're just on a feel-good thing on paper, or whether there's actually anything done with them. Because it's hard to explain to a citizen who is saying, well, here you have this law, and you supposedly have standards, and yet people are doing essentially anything they want. And help me deal with that and have an answer for people.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, these are what the state has are minimum standards, and they're administered by the local government. Now, the local government is the one that makes any variance approvals or building permit approvals. And they're the ones that approve the development. The state, if a local government gets too far afield, our recourse is to sue them. I mean, we have general oversight that looks at, and we provide them assistance and technical assistance. But for any hard oversight, the only way for us to take a city or a county to task would be to sue them if we felt they approved a project that was inconsistent with their own ordinance, that they didn't meet the hardship definition in the enabling statutes for counties or cities. So that our recourse is just like it would be for any other group or citizen would be to litigate if we felt they made a wrong decision.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Lacismo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These standards also then looked at developing better management of stormwater runoff. They did propose larger lot sizes for new lots on general development lakes and would limit backwater access or limit access from back lots to the lakes. So, you know, we went through this, the alternative standards. There's a third sheet, I think, in your packet that shows counties colored in green and yellow. The green counties are the ones that have adopted portions of these alternative standards already. And the yellow counties are counties that are considering those standards. There aren't any counties that have adopted the entire package of alternative standards, but they are considering it. We're in the very early phases of the development of those standards, and we do have been marketing them to various counties. There's four training sessions coming up in March and early April for local governments, local zoning officials, so they better understand that the provisions that are in these standards. So it is a work in progress, and we are seeing some counties adopt the measures that they feel is important for them. Two points that I could bring up that I see as potential problems for shoreland management are that in the last several years, there's been nonconformity language that's passed in Chapter 462 and 394 that allow nonconforming structures to be rebuilt. And we did have a limitation for rebuilding in floodplain areas, and because there certainly are some problems with federal law if nonconformities are rebuilt in the floodway. But right now, there isn't any such exception for shoreland areas, so you could have a structure that's built, you know, very close to the lake or at the lake shore that's damaged, that could be totally rebuilt under that law. So that may deserve some looking at. And the other thing over the last couple of years is we have seen various bills introduced to deal with the contiguously owned nonconforming lots, and that we allow development on each of those lots and allow them to be spilled. That's something that local government's been dealing with for the last couple of decades, and I believe rather effectively. So I would urge you to use caution when considering those bills. That's very quickly an overview of where we are on the shoreland management program, and I could answer any further questions if you have them at this time.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Lacasmo, you mentioned the map that shows which counties have adopted elements of your alternative shoreland ordinance, but I don't see the map. And
I, Steve. It's a white sheet of paper. You just flipped it. It's the bottom one there. It's the outside.
The one in your. It's right on the top of the.
It's there. Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, Mr. Lacasmo. With regards to your last comment about the bills that are floating around with regards to that, can you explain a little bit better to me and what you're suggesting we not accept?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Over the last 2 years, there have been bills that have passed that allowed nonconformities to be replaced if they were damaged. And that's something that may want to think about as we look at shoreland management, whether or not that's a practice that should be looked at and have some restrictions in the shoreland zone. I believe the counties may wish to discuss that when they testify, or they may be contacting you about that specifically. But I know there have been concerns by local governments about how that would be administered in the shoreland district. Second issue was whether or not how you deal with non-conforming lots of record. When you have two 50-foot lots on a lake that are in the common ownership and the standard is now 75 feet wide, there have been proposals to be able to subdivide that property and have two developable lots when those lots are in common ownership. And they've been proposed in recent years. No legislation has passed, and we would have concerns over that legislation.
Mr. Chairman?
Wilson.
Mr. Chairman, to those points, is your recommendation to have some kind of compensation when taking away the people's ability to use their land as it has traditionally been built, the idea of rebuilding a nonconforming use?
Mr. Chairman.
You're taking away, you know, some significant value there. You would think that there would need to be, it could be a de facto condemnation. What is your position or stance on an alternative to allowing them to rebuild?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, what we'd like to see is at least legislation that allows local government to consider options and not be forced into just issuing a building permit for exactly what was there, because there may be options that would be increasing the setback and still allowing reasonable use. So, but the way I understand the language is currently worded, it takes away some of the local government's prerogative to evaluate and make a reasoned local decision.
Thank you.
Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Loxmo, is the DNR on a timetable to take out the word voluntary? Are they ready to, on the next update of rules, talk about not being voluntary?
Mr. Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scogin, what we've committed to is looking at the process of and what would it take to make a new statewide mandatory rule. We went into the alternative shoreland standards and developed that process with a group of stakeholders as a voluntary process. And had it been a mandatory statewide process, would have the outcome been the same? I don't know. But we're concerned about the switching gears now at the end of that process and attempting to make that exact rule statewide and mandatory. If we're going to do that, we should start up front with a statewide mandatory rule, a broader group of stakeholders, including the ag interests or other interests that may be impacted, and developing it. And we would use the information that's already been developed. I think there's a lot of great information and good standards developed in this North Central Lakes standards process. We would certainly use that information. And right now, we're looking at what it would take to develop a statewide mandatory rule.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was along the same lines. First, I just need a slightly better understanding of the current minimum thresholds you were describing in your presentation and in your conversation with Senator Olson. So original rules were developed in the 70s, and then there's an update to those in the 80s. Are those minimal rules? Are those mandatory? Are those non-voluntary, the minimum thresholds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, they are mandatory. The last rule was a 1989 rule that combined the county and the municipal rules into one, but that's a statewide mandatory minimum shoreland rule.
And I'm curious to know, Mr. Luxman, what sort of development has occurred? You know, what's the rate? Or I was reading in your materials kind of what led to the or part of the dynamic that led to the update of the rules was, you know, an increase in development along lakes and sensitive lakes of like 75%. What kind of development have we seen since then?
Mr. Locke,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, certainly in the last decade, development has been increasing significantly, I think due to technology, due to maybe more income, more baby boomers retiring, and you're seeing cabins being converted to permanent year-round homes. There's a different trend. And there is only so much lakeshore, and you're seeing the more marginal lakeshore being developed. I mean, that certainly is a trend that exists.
So does DNR keep close track of that, inventory that, really have some good data on hand to really tell us what we're seeing?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it's not something that we keep close track of. I mean, the two times that we've done shoreland rules, both in the 70s and in 1989, they were preceded by a specific study that was, funded and then an analysis done as part of that.
Mm-hmm. So, and one final.
Okay.
So, I understand and respect. You know, you entered into this process with the understanding. At least with the counties as stakeholders, local authorities as stakeholders, that we're going to develop some voluntary rules to incent their participation and buy into the process. But it seems to me, I agree. You know, everyone knows, we've talked about it quite a bit, the level of development pressure on the lakes is tremendous, and its effect, its impact is indisputable. So if we're going to just create this voluntary approach that local authorities can adopt, are there ways to further incent their adoption of some of these development, you know, through, I don't know, whatever mechanisms the DNR has available to it?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
other than the obvious, which is, you know, your lakes are going to be far more attractive and usable, and that's better for you as a local authority and good for all of us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, yes, there would be. One of the things that happened in 1989, as part of that process, there was an appropriation made to help defray the cost of local governments to adopt those rules. And those funds continue to help with administration. And you could look at, and right now those funds are actually administered through Bowser because the funds are distributed according to a formula. So it's not a, but you could look at adjusting that formula or giving credits for communities, counties that adopt specific standards, that they would get a bonus in those funds. And there's about, it's a little under $500,000 that goes out to the various governments for that right now.
Senator Dibble. And I know the DNR partners with local communities, local authorities, on lots of different efforts, partner with your dollars, you know, leverage dollars, match dollars, and that sort of thing. And it would make sense to me that, I know, if folks are wanting to use statewide resources, you know, through DNR dollars to do good things on water quality and water mitigation, that, you know, that adopting some of these things that we know are going to have a positive benefit and outcome might be a good first step to say, we're happy to come in and help you out with your surface water issues, but we want to know that you're managing your surface waters to the best of your ability as well. So leveraging some of those programmatic dollars to a good effect.
Okay, we need to move on to the next witness. Thank you very much.
Welcome. Thank you.
Paula West, Minnesota Waters.
It's locked. We have a locked computer, so we just need a second here.
It'll only work for me.
Slideshow from it. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paula West. I am Director of Communications and Outreach for Minnesota Waters. We are a statewide nonprofit organization that works on lake and river protection, and the recent merger of the Minnesota Lakes Association and the Rivers Council of Minnesota. And I would like to provide you this just quickly an overview of what is happening on our shorelands today to further comment on what Mr. Lacosmo has just presented to you, because I think providing some background on the trends that we are seeing puts it all into perspective about why we are concerned about making sure as we develop our shorelands in the future that we do it in a way that we protect the quality of those resources so that we can ensure that future generations can also enjoy the water resources that all of us are privileged to enjoy in this state. We all know that lakes and rivers are important to Minnesota. We have over 208,000 miles of shoreline. That's more miles of shoreline than the states of California, Hawaii, and Florida combined. We have 64,000 miles of natural rivers and streams, one licensed boat for every Minnesotan. Water bodies comprise almost 5% of the whole surface area of Minnesota. And we have 5,400 fishable lakes, and 93% of our residents fish on Minnesota's lakes. We know that we're proud of them. It's on our license plate. We say we're the land of 10,000 lakes when actually we have 11,888 lakes in Minnesota. And it's on our new state quarter, so it is an important resource to us. Well, back in the 50s and 60s, we had the trend of going up north started in Minnesota as our roads made Minnesota's lakes more accessible. First, it was the cabin at the lake. Maybe some of you still have cabins at the lake. And then starting in the 1970s and 80s, the character of our lake regions began to change drastically as technology made long-distance communication less experience. And in the last 15 years that we've had high-speed computers and internet and cell phones, people can now live and work where they used to vacation. And the lake regions of Minnesota are changing as people move to the high-amenity areas of Minnesota that are characterized by our hills, our trees, and our waters. Today, many of our shorelands, particularly in north-central Minnesota, are starting to look like this, castles or cabins. Now, this is an exaggeration. This is Gull Lake and probably one of the highest affluent areas of lake development, but this is happening all over our shorelands in Minnesota, little starter castles. And the type of development on our shorelands is changing as well. As you can see here on, I guess it'd be on your right, the little cabin. Next to it is a larger home. There was a cabin there 3 years ago, and now it's been replaced with this major home. So we're seeing a lot of not only new development, but we're seeing what we call redevelopment on our shorelines. We have a lot of planned unit developments that are showing up as well. When the original state shoreland rules were written in the 1970s, they encouraged clustering of larger shoreland developments to maintain a pleasing aesthetic quality of our shorelands. But now what we're seeing happen is that these planned unit developments are being strung across the lakeshore, creating rather obtrusive changes in the character of our lakes. Well, as Mr. Lacasmo pointed out, with our general development and recreational developments largely already developed, the development pressure is now moving to the marginal shorelands of Minnesota. We have 5,000 shallow lakes in Minnesota, a lot more than I think most people realize. And we have about 2,600 general development lakes and recreational development lakes. That leaves approximately 9,000 natural environment lakes in Minnesota that have been classified, some of which look like this. This is very natural shoreline on a marginal lake. So where the pressures are happening is on these natural environment lakes, as well as bays of our larger lakes that have not been developed in the past for obvious reasons. And when the original shoreland rules were written, they didn't really adequately address this kind of shoreland because we really didn't think back in the 1970s that this type of shoreland was going to be developed in Minnesota. And rivers, our 64,000 miles of river, they're the next frontier of shoreland development. There are many rivers already that are seeing development pressure. The section of the Mississippi River between Anoka and St. Cloud is experiencing considerable amounts of shoreland pressure at this time. Well, there isn't any more available waterfront, and it's rapidly disappearing. And one of the things that we're also seeing is a decline in the family resorts in Minnesota. I don't expect you to see these numbers real clearly, but what they do show is that part of our heritage is slipping away from us. Small resorts can no longer afford to really make it financially feasible to stay as family resorts. That is one part of the alternative standards that does help them to stay in business. We also want to point out to you that 35% of Minnesota's primary recreational lakes, that's our general development lakes and our recreational development lakes, have at least one aquatic invasive species. Four inland lakes in Minnesota have zebra mussels, three of which are within 30 miles of the Brainerd Lakes area. 190 lakes and rivers and streams with Eurasian water milfoil first discovered in 1989 in Lake Minnetonka, and over 800 lakes with curly-leaf pondweed, the newest and probably one of the worst invasive species that we have because it causes damages to water quality. Well, development is inevitable as long as we have shorelands and as long as people are building homes, we're going to build on our shorelands. And nobody is against developing our shorelands, but the questions that we have to ask and answer effectively is how much development are we going to have on our shorelands, where are we going to develop our shorelands, and how are we going to develop our shorelands? Those are the critical questions as we go forward that are going to make the difference in terms of whether we continue to enjoy the use of our lakes in the future. As we've developed our shorelands outside of the metro area, we've brought some of that metropolitan, our suburban mentality. This is not news, as Senator Olson was pointing out, around Lake Minnetonka, but now we see this in our rural lakes as well. And when we bring this suburban lawn to the lake, we've now just created a great conduit for fertilizers and runoffs to get into our lake and potentially impair water quality. The impact of development on lakes is, you can see we're adding riprap, we're adding shrubbery, we're adding lawns, and this is displacing the natural shoreline that was there. You can see this is the lot, this is what this lot looked like. The lot next door is in what the lake looked like in its natural state. In this particular lot, a lot of the emergent vegetation was removed. And we're destroying a lot of this vegetation, which Henry is going to talk about in a few minutes. But this has value to our lakes in terms of our fish and wildlife habitat. And as we've continued to develop, we add more impervious surfaces, all that rock and the roofs, materials like cement and asphalt and roofing. They're all compacted, and they prevent the percolation of water runoff into the land. And so, again, we have more runoff that's coming into our lakes. I'd like to just show you quickly a comparison of the amount of runoff volume, the phosphorus. Phosphorus is a natural element, but it is also the source of food for algae in our lakes. It impairs water quality and can lead to decreasing water quality in our lakes. And then the sediment that also can run off from our shorelands also contains a phosphorus. On the left here, you have a natural shoreline. And there's a certain amount of just baseline runoff and phosphorus and sediment that you will find in natural conditions. Now, in the middle, we've got a cabin. You can still see that there's still some emergent vegetation. There's some shrubs and probably reminiscent of more of what development looked like in the 70s and 80s. And now with this type of development, you can see that we have the same amount of runoff volume as our undeveloped shoreline, same amount of phosphorus, but now we've got four times more sediment. When you take the type of development that we have on the right, where we've cleared out the vegetation, we've added rock and things, we tremendously increase the amount of runoff by 5%, the amount of phosphorus by 7 times as much, and the amount of sediment by 18 times as much. And this can all have consequences for water quality. And fish and wildlife habitat. In many areas, we're turning our lakes into parking lots for boats, and then we wonder why there's no fish there to catch because there's no vegetation to support them. And what about the economics of shoreline development? This is a great, I'm not a fisher person, but I think it's a walleye. We'd all like to catch a fish like that. This guy, he's caught this fish, and now he's going to go into the bar at night, and he's going to brag about it, and he's going to spend some money there, and he's going to go to the gas station, and he's going to buy gas, and he's going to go to the grocery store and buy, you know, minnows and snacks to go out fishing. Well, the economics of our keeping our waters clean in Minnesota is huge. Tourism is a $9.2 billion industry in Minnesota, more than the agricultural industry in Minnesota. We pay, I'm just going to back up. How do you back up, Henry?
Page up or arrow up.
Fishing alone is a $1 billion industry in Minnesota. That's more than the revenues at the Mall of America in 1 year. And we have over $250 billion worth of lakeshore property that are helping to fuel our local economy. So it's not just about recreation. It's not about aesthetics. Keeping our waters clean and clear and usable is about the economics of this state as well. This is a study that was done at Bemidji State. several years ago that showed that as water clarity decreases, as water clarity increases, property values increase as well. But the study also showed that as water clarity decreases, that property values will decline as well. And declining property values not only have personal impacts, but they have impacts to local economies as well. Well, one point I want to strongly make is that water quality is determined by what we do on the land, primarily by what we do on the land. Water quality didn't change dramatically until man started to inhabit our shorelands. And so I think it's a very key point to keep in mind that what we do on our land is impacting our waters. And how we use our land is basically and primarily determined by local governments. And also, you as state legislators have opportunities to set guidelines that can provide assistance to local governments in their challenges in setting good land use regulations. We all have opportunities, whether we're individuals, whether we're communities, or whether we're local governments, state governments, to protect Minnesota's lakes. There are a number of challenges that local governments are facing today, and that is the fact that, as Mr. Lacismo pointed out, our shoreland ordinances in Minnesota were written in the early 70s, last updated in 1989, and they currently do not address the kind of pressure that is happening on our shorelands today. So counties are having to update their shoreland ordinances frequently. In your packet is a letter from John Sumption, the Environmental Services Director from Cass County. They have updated their shoreland ordinance 22 times since 1989 to keep up with the pressure that is happening in their county. Development pressures are happening faster than these counties can revise their shoreland ordinances. And also, there's the whole idea of short-term property tax gains versus long-term sustainable property values. Sometimes local officials see the added property tax values of increasing development, but they fail to also see the increased infrastructure that will be required to sustain that, and to realize that if they put in place good regulations to protect the shorelands, they also are protecting the property tax base that the property tax gains are based on. That protecting our water quality in the long term is protecting property tax values. And then there's the issue of enforcement, whether it's the current rules or new rules. Local governments oftentimes don't have the resources to adequately enforce their current shoreland rules, and also the issue that Mr. Lacismo brought up about non-conforming structures is a real challenge for local governments who are trying to do the right thing, and they're being their hands are tied somewhat in that issue as well. In the Clean Water Legacy discussion, there is protection monies. We urge you to consider allocating more money if Clean Water Legacy appropriations do happen for protection that could get back to these local governments to help with that through the mechanism that is already established in the Natural Resource Block Grants. Well, I would just like to end with saying we appreciate your concern in protecting the real liquid assets of Minnesota, our lakes and our rivers. We have at your packet there in front of you is a copy of a DVD called Minnesota's Lakes at Risk that Minnesota Waters recently produced with Twin Cities Public Television that has a lot of the data that you're hearing today in it and was designed as a training tool for local government. So I encourage you to take that and to view it at your own leisure. And I will turn it over to Henry Van Offlin now, unless anyone on the committee has a question for me.
Senator Engelbertson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just a couple questions. What's the shallow lake? What's the depth there? Also, second question. The impact on resort reduction. Used to have a lot of resorts in my district. Mm-hmm. They're going down. What do you attribute that to? Do you attribute that to inability to do decent construction without having to adhere to certain regulations, or just the value of the property being out taxed off their property?
Senator, Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, in terms of small resorts, financially, it's difficult for them to make a living. You know, the season is short, it's also the value of the land that their resorts is sitting on is more valuable than the resort operation itself, and so they're being approached. Many of them are being approached by developers who want to buy the resorts and develop it into planned unit developments or residential units. That is one of the real values of the resort section of the alternative standards, is that it allows these small resorts to expand in ways that they haven't been able to before. They also have to do some mitigation to make sure there's no pressures to the water. They have to make sure their septic systems are conforming. They have to put in some vegetative cover to make sure that they're not producing more runoff into the lake. But it does allow them to expand. Now, the way the alternative standards are set up is that if their resort then is bought out by a developer and turned into a residential unit, then they have to meet the planned unit development standards, which are stricter. So it kind of puts some checks and balances in place. And your first shallow, question, shallow lakes. The average depth is 15 feet for a shallow lake. I think that's correct. And as I said, we do have around 5,000 shallow lakes in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Further questions, Senator Olson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Your new organization, Minnesota Waters, is the merger of the Minnesota Lakes Association and the Rivers. Is the membership of the I thought Minnesota Lakes Association was largely made up of members that are residents along the shoreline. Is that correct, and is that still the case? That your organization is serving people who are already living on along lakes and rivers?
Ms. West.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's largely true. Our membership is about 3,000 individuals, 350 lake associations, which are about 75% of all the lake associations in Minnesota, and we have 15 county coalitions of lake associations. We do have local governments. We do have county soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts that also support us, but largely we do represent a lakeshore interest of about 80,000 people.
So Mr. Chairman, so, and Ms. West, I just want to commend you. I think you've got a very high-quality presentation, and I think you've effectively presented it. Does it reflect, you know, one of the things we're dealing with a lot in any kind of development is that the kind of belief that I'm here now, shut the door? Or is it? Do you see that is partly operative, or not necessarily a close the door, but let's have some standards and try to do things, and maybe some of us will have to change our behavior too if we're going to protect the water quality.
Ms. West,
which would you say describes the
Mr. Chairman, philosophy? Senator Olson? Well, we would hope our membership would support the latter, that you know, the greater interest of the protection of the water resources. Yes, there is privilege that comes with living on lakeshore, but there is also responsibility that comes with living on lakeshore. And the waters of Minnesota are public waters. We have had all the county coalitions of lake associations that belong to our organization have recently sent letters to the DNR and to the governor saying they support stronger statewide shoreland standards, knowing that that may mean they have to make some changes as well. I think as we go forward, it is imperative that we all realize that we've got to find a way to balance development with protection of water quality, and that we all have a piece that we have to do, even if we don't live on lakes, using them responsibly when we go to them.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, Mr. Van Offlin, you want to go next?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for holding this informational hearing today on shorelands. I think it's an issue that certainly, given the alt standards process, it's perfect timing for this sort of informational hearing. I did want to mention also that both Paula and I were on the alt standards steering committee, and really much of the presentation that we're both giving here today is sort of in 20 or 30 minutes what we spent probably 5 or 6 three- or four-hour meetings going through in the ALT standards. So we're giving you sort of a rundown of the current certain trends and science on shorelands that we did receive in the ALT standards rule development process. My name's Henry Van Offlin. I'm with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And really what's driving everything is population growth. And this is perhaps you've seen this before in some other presentations, but this is the projected housing density in the north central region of the U.S. from 1940 out to 2030. And you'll note that Lake Country in Minnesota is turning from green to lighter colors, and portions in west central Minnesota, say where I live in Detroit Lakes, are turning from light colors to darker red colors. Population growth is what's driving the changes we're seeing in Lake Country and river country, because this is, we sometimes seem to focus on the lakes issues. This is about rivers too. Another depiction of that population growth, the north central counties in the darker colors are seeing that growth. That's in part why the 5-county area was picked, because those are the areas that are seeing the fastest growth. And what I'm going to go over here is just some of the effects of shoreland development on water quality, reiterate some of what Paula said, get a little more specific with what we know about fish and wildlife changes due to shoreland development, talk a little bit about the economics, talk about exactly some of the real specifics in the ALT standards and how those are good solutions to meet the challenges that we faced. And then lastly, what is the future? This is a lake in Canada that they put a curtain across that you see there. They added phosphorus, carbon and nitrogen. Again, Paula mentioned phosphorus is the key nutrient. It is the limiting nutrient in aquatic systems that are freshwater. And when phosphorus is added, the lake for 8 years turned very much pea soup green, as we see in the slide. So phosphorus is the critical element that we're dealing with in Minnesota. This is a curve of phosphorus versus water clarity. So as you get higher in phosphorus on the right of the graph, the water clarity goes down. And there's kind of a tipping point that we've identified in Minnesota lakes that around somewhere in that 25 to 30 parts per billion range, all of a sudden a lake will switch to be a much more turbid, less clear lake system. And down at the bottom, there's a reference from going from 15 to 25 parts per billion, you go from 12.5 to 8 feet of water clarity. We also know historically, scientists have gone and taken cores. This is a picture on the left of a lake sediment core. On the right are diatoms. They're an algae that has a silica glass-like shell. And we can, scientists can go take those cores and basically date back what the phosphorus level in our lakes has been. And what they found is clearly since the early 1900s in the metropolitan region, phosphorus levels have increased dramatically and statistically significantly. So we know that we are having an effect on our lakes through development. Another one, phosphorus load versus impervious cover. As the amount of impervious cover increases, so does the load of phosphorus going into our waters. And Paula mentioned this also, just the development impacts on the water cycle. And this sort of gets back to probably what we learned in second or third or fourth grade with the water cycle. You have in the left there a natural landscape where very little, 0 to 10% runs off, 50% infiltrates into the ground. You get modest development, more runoff, less into the ground, and when you get substantial development and impervious surfaces, considerably more runoff directly to our surface waters and less going into the ground. A little bit different way to look at this, if you have a 1-acre meadow, it's about 1,000 gallons of water will run off an acre of land from a 1-inch rainfall. If you have an acre of solid impervious, 25,000. So, and then scientists have taken this and have done build-out predictions, and this is from Itasca County, actually. The green line is the total phosphorus that on the left is natural, and then it moves over to more and more development. You see that it's going from, at least the model predicts, that it'll go from somewhere in the about 18 range up into the 25 range, depending on how much development we have. And this refers back to that 25 or 30 parts per billion of phosphorus is really something that seems to be a tipping point for many of our lakes. And then this brings us to fish. And that's what my background actually is in as a fisheries biologist. And there's been some very good science on the impacts of development on fish. Up in the Brainerd Lakes area, Paul Radomski, who also worked on the ALT standards process, did some work looking at the amount, the sizes, numbers, and species diversity on lakes, comparing natural shorelines to developed shorelines. And not surprisingly, there were more fish of more different species in natural shorelines. They also found in that study that on developed shorelines, on average, 66% of our vegetation, whether it was emergent or submerged, had also been was reduced by 66%, the amount of vegetation. So I think we all recognize that this is happening. And we now have some good science from the last 15 to 20 years that demonstrates it is impacting our fish populations. This is a study done in the Alexandria area by some fish researchers in Glenwood. This is one of three lakes. All three lakes show the same consistent trend. If you look, the stars are either bass nesting sites or black crappie nesting sites. The green shoreline is undeveloped. The yellow is in areas that there are actually no dwellings, and then the red is heavily developed shorelands. Clearly, bass and crappies are selecting those undeveloped natural shorelines for spawning. So, clearly development is having an effect. Switching over to wildlife and their habitats along shorelines, this slide shows the percent of plant cover on the bottom and whether or not there's tree canopy or shrubs. And you can see that in both, well, for both shrubs and tree canopy, undeveloped shoreline has substantially more plant cover, more habitat for critters. Similar things happen with songbirds. You get species shifts to what they're calling less common or less desirable birds on developed lakes compared to undeveloped lakes. And perhaps if you own a lake area, Lake Home, you've perhaps seen this. And then finally, frogs. What's happening to the frogs? And sometimes some folks refer to frogs and amphibians as the canary in the coal mine. But as you get more homes per mile, you see fewer and fewer frogs per mile. So that's what's been happening. I just wanted to touch on some economic data, and this is from Wisconsin. Paula mentioned the water clarity work, that water clarity was directly related to property value. There's also been some work done in Wisconsin that looked at putting more restrictive shoreland regulations on several lakes for several years. And they had 1,000 property sales between these lakes. They were seeing all that even though they went from 100 to 300-foot minimum lot sizes, the property values were increasing on those lakes. So there is some value for having more conservative rules and regulations. Just as, in the metro area, there's a lot of stuff on open space now that's showing that open space is a very important component that makes something more desirable.
Big question, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Van Olfillen. When you said you made a flat statement about the contrast between the developed and undeveloped, is there an assumption with the developed lake that a lot of loss of natural habitat has occurred? In other words, is it the presence of a house, or is it the issue of whether houses can be there if they're put in a way that does minimal destruction to the general natural habitat around it?
Mr. Van Olfillen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. I think, and we'll get a little bit to that, there is a new science for better development of parcels of property, particularly along shorelands. In those studies, it was simply developed or undeveloped. And we're seeing, especially with aquatic vegetation, substantial reductions along developed shoreline, which is, that is, the homes for lots of critters and food supply, et cetera. So I think you could maybe, it would be really interesting to do that sort of study where we had developed shoreline that was done in, say, using the habitat friendly or the development, the good sorts of development that are preserving some of the natural features, and compare that to the sort of the classic lawn to the water's edge. I think that would be a good study to do.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Van Offelen, in your slide where you have the curtain going across the lake and you have the green lake and the clear lake on one side, what's your best guess bringing that lake back to that condition as to how long it would take and what kind of means would it take to do something like that? Or is it impossible?
Mr. Van Offelen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's where we're at now. I mean, that's a critical question of do we protect something before it goes to that state, or do we, you know, assume that, well, if it gets far enough, we can somehow fix it? And protection always seems far and away the best strategy when you come to natural systems. They're very difficult to return to their natural state. And if we look at, there's a lot of good science going on right now with shallow lakes, and perhaps you've heard of that, where they are either in a clear phase or a turbid phase. And there's some good work going on to try and figure out, can we actually get them to go from, if they turn into the turbid phase, high phosphorus, lots of algae, can we get them back to a clear phase that instead of algae, they have aquatic rooted plants? And those are very difficult things to do, turning natural systems back.
Thank you.
It costs a lot of money to do that.
Absolutely.
You could bring it back to clear. A lot of effort, a lot of resources. Or we can just plan ahead. Senator?
Just a follow-up comment on that. In my hometown of Alexandria, we have a couple small lakes that we're looking at that color at one time, and it's been 25 years we've been trying to bring that back, and now just this last year they're starting to swim in one of those lakes. So it takes a long time. We're better off to do it now, you're right.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I do know of one case, actually right in Detroit Lakes. Lake Sally used to essentially be the tertiary pond for the sewage system there. It was pea soup green. The sewage system for the city had several ponds and then ended up in a ditch going into a shallow lake and then into Lake Sally. That lake had incredible water quality problems in the 70s and early 80s, and through, you know, upscaling septic systems and upgrading the city's sewage system, it has now come back. There is hope, but it sure would have been a lot less expensive to have just managed things from the start.
Is Christina in your district, Lake Christina? Classic example.
Yep.
Classic. Go ahead, Mr. Van Offelen.
Thank you. So, yeah, I was coming to a summary. Basically, all the science is telling us development increases runoff. We didn't talk about recreational use here, but clearly that's an issue that you'll hear about from Dead Lake in particular later. We've got water quality reductions. It's fragmenting habitats. And in the long term, we're going to be looking at reduced long-term economic potential values for shorelands. And that's where the alt standards come into place. I think the DNR recognized what was happening and went through this process. And if anybody, I'd really encourage you to go to DNR's website and look at these materials, because they put together some outstanding stuff on what's happening to our shorelands today. And these rules are really there for trying to meet those challenges. And I can't say enough about the process that we both sat in on. Was a very open process where there was lots of very good discussion of all the issues that we presented, plus many more, especially from the Planning and Zoning Administrator and County Commissioner sides of things. So they have two very good documents. And the second one there is the assessment and rationale, which really lays out a lot of this science and justification for rules. And I'm just going to go over here as quickly as I can some of the key components of what's in these rules, following up a little bit more on what Mr. Lacasmo said. Key components from my perspective, and the fact sheet that you have from DNR does go over most of these. There's a bunch of new and revised definitions For example, the resort definition is a new one. That was probably not as well defined as it could have been back. I don't know if that's from 1971 or when the things were updated. There's multiple shoreland classifications, and I'm going to talk a little bit about an example later. Right now, if a lake is a general development lake, the whole lakeshore is a general development lake. Well, we all know that there's lakes that are big and deep that have shallow bays. We're seeing development pressures on those shallow bays now, which we hadn't seen 10 or 20 years ago. And those shallow bays really are more like a shallow, sensitive lake than they are the deep lake. So this allows the alternate standards give you the ability to take pieces of shoreland and classify them, say, as natural environment rather than general development. There's also a new lake class in there, a special protection lake class. So right now we have general development, recreational development, natural environment. This gives a special protection lake class also. We talked a little bit about shoreland access lots, this idea of folks buying property that may have one lot and then 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 back lots and funneling pressure to the lake. That is forbidden in the new ALT standards unless you're doing a planned unit development. There's new planned unit development standards. I'll talk a little bit about that in an example here. There's land subdivision standards, resorts, water quality issues. The science of stormwater management is much further along now than it was 15 or 20 years ago. A lot of those standards or suggestions of where to go for that are in the new standards. And then there's a section on administration. And this is an example from that assessment and rationale document. This is what we would typically see on a parcel of land. And you've got 20 lots total, 9 on the lake, individual docks. In the new standards, on a recreational development lake, we'd have 10 lots, 6 lake lots. So there is a reduction in the new standards. And in part, that was because after long discussion in the ALT standards process, there's really been a move towards this conservation development side of things. And this would be a conservation development in the ALT standards, allowed under the ALT standards, where you're back up to 19 homes, you have one centralized dock, you're staying away from the wetland, you are you have a lot of common open space. So that's what I think we all came to the conclusion in the ALT standards, that this is sort of the direction we need to go with what's left with our remaining shorelines. It allows for development, it allows for density similar to what we would expect now. It's just we're getting smarter about where we're putting stuff, so that we can preserve the quality of our lakes. This is an example from the Detroit Lakes area of your classic lot and block development going on a recreational development lake. And I just want to point out T-Cracker, where you see the A and B, that is a 120-acre lake. The only bit of shoreline, all the rest of the shoreline is publicly owned as part of Tamarack National Wildlife Refuge. And they had proposed 11 lots going in on A and B. Even though the county has a very good environmental review process and told them, no, you need to do some sort of conservation development, they stuck all the way up to the Planning Commission meeting with the with a standard lot and block. And this is an air photo of that area. T-Cracker is the lake in the upper side above the B there. And it's 120 acres. The entire lake is fringed with wild rice. That's where development is moving these days. And we need some standards to reflect that. This is an example from Detroit Lakes area. This just gets your bearings. Detroit Lake is on the right-hand side. The Pelican River is on the top. And there's another lake on the left-hand side with Highway 59 there. The city annexed 58 acres, magically, you know, under the 60-acre limit in order to go to public hearings. So. And then this is a picture of what they propose there. There's 130. This is underneath the current PUD standards. 130 RV park pads is what you see there. The yellow is wetland area. Okay, so under the current standards, those are the densities that are allowed. And the current standards and definitions don't define clustering very well. They consider these clusters. They also don't define open space very well. On this drawing, they claim 60% open space for this development on those 42 acres. Because they can count every piece of ground that isn't either a road or a building site. So this is a 60% open space development that is being touted. I would call the areas in red a cluster. If you take the clusters and the wetlands and the roads, I don't see nearly 60% open space in this example. But this is what is currently allowed underneath the current standards. In the alt standards, this is how they propose to deal with clustering. It's much better defined. Those areas shaded are what you have. That's what you count as your cluster. That does not count for your open space. So it makes a lot more sense to get us in the densities that probably some of this land is suitable for. I just wanted to, this is another good one for what's happening. This is that site. This is the Pelican River on the north end of that parcel. In order to fit six of those units in at the end, they had to construct this 10-foot tall wall in order to fit them on the edge. And, you know, just for six units, they built a 300-foot long wall that's 10 feet high. We did get it reduced down to 4 feet after the fact. But some of the issues that are going on, I'll just throw Pelican Lake is in Otter Tail County. Fish Lake is a lake off of Pelican, and this is the area, again, this is that shallow bay being developed with a large development. Just another example. And this gets us pretty much to the end of what I was going to cover. You know, we're sitting here with a voluntary approach. We have all these pressures, and we're not convinced that the voluntary approach is certainly going to work. I've got several things in the packet after the slides there for you to take a look at. And we think it's time to reset the bar and go to statewide rulemaking. We've MCA petitioned DNR to go statewide, rejected, and now we're waiting for a plan from DNR for how we move forward non-voluntary. There's a bunch of other stuff in the packet to look at. A letter from John Sumption indicating from his county's perspective what's happening. That's on page 17. I also took DNR's, on page 16, this table with all the different counties that have adopted things. And please note at the bottom all the counties that we don't know about that have a lot of natural environment lakes. So the last point, we also have page 19 is a question that we sent out to a bunch of counties. I think I sent it to 25. I got 8 responses on this question. Just to get sort of a feel for, I'd look at respondent 3 on page 19. We asked, list the ordinance changes that the county is going to consider and how they're related to the alt standards. We would like to suggest shoreland ordinance changes in 2007, and then it goes on to say, I'll try and do this, but if the board says no, it's not my fault, they're not stronger protections, the new board will be difficult. And some of the other responses are also similar to that. So in the packet is a few other items for information. And, you know, I don't think we see shoreland rules as the panacea to fix all our problems in our waters, but we certainly need to move ahead and use the alt standards as a base. And, you know, we also, after we do some good rulemaking, I think we need to move into, you know, looking at how our shoreland management system is funded, administered, and enforced, as has been brought up before.
Thank you very much. Questions for the witness? Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I represent 2.5 counties that are in agricultural area. McLeod County this past year passed a new planning and zoning ordinance to protect all environment lakes and not allow any development within 1,000 feet of the lake. And they probably have about 20 natural environment lakes in their county. So no development within 1,000 feet of these lakes. They started out at 1,200 feet or a quarter of a mile, but compromised down to 1,000 feet. And the second significant thing they did is they said there'll be no further subdivisions, residential development units more than 2 miles from a city limits. What is your reaction to that kind of planning and zoning?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill. Well, I think that is what know, is the local government's prerogative. They are in the, ultimate control. The state sets the bar for development standards along shorelands. That it actually is, the shoreland zone is typically 1,000 feet. You know, that's what we're suggesting here, is that we need to reset the bar, just as we did back in 89. And then counties and other local governments, we didn't even bring up cities. There's a dozen cities in Crow Wing County, for example, that may have different rules than the county. That, I mean, counties are always going to have that ability to have flexibility underneath the statewide minimums. So I don't, other than that, I hadn't heard that. I'm not familiar with that. Those seem like very strict regulations.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I think it's probably the strictest in the state. And I've commended my county for doing that.
Question for Mr. Knopf. Are there shoreline standards in statute now?
Mr. Chairman, members, the what the statutes contain is a direction for rulemaking of the Department of Natural Resources for shoreland standards. So the standards are set in rule, but the directive is that the state come up with the model standards or the standards, the minimum standards, and each county and municipality is supposed to adopt those standards. If they don't adopt those standards, or if those standards are not up to the model standards, then the DNR has the authority to go ahead and adopt standards for the area and charge back the cost of adopting the standards on the local unit of government, is the way it works. And then, but then the end of this, the standards themselves are actually established by the DNR.
But statute directs that each county implement those standards?
Mr. Chairman, yes, each county, for those lakes that are within municipalities, for those also, for the municipalities. But then DNR, if they're not sufficient or they don't go through with it, their authority is to go in and adopt the standards for those areas and then charge back the cost of the adoption to them.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, clarify something for me on these alternative shoreland management standards. Is that available to all counties throughout the state and all municipalities? Or how, what's the unit or the – yeah, we've got the map showing where they've been adopted. How does it apply to the metropolitan area? Is that – is any are any of these elements available as a tool there?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Chairman and Senator Olson, yes. Those are available. They've been posted and finalized in December 2005, and – as Mr. Lacasmo has said, they're available for counties to or other local governments to grab. And what we're seeing on the map is really, I think, from my perspective, quite a bit of very selective cherry picking. You'll see the resort section a lot of folks are taking parts of, somewhat the plan unit development. And we saw that as, you know, in the committee that developed those rules, the whole thing is a package, and there were compromises in that package. For example, taking the resort section, not taking the PUDs section, really doesn't get you where we wanted to be. So
Senator Olson, and we need to get to the public
testimony. Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Van Elfelen, as you were speaking, I hate to bring up another illustration, but it is the kind of thing that is extremely frustrating. When you were talking about sometimes large lakes, bays of them are in fact more shallow lakes. Now, there is one like that on Lake Minnetonka, and there was a very large parcel of land in single ownership that wanted to subdivide into estate-type lots of like 11 acres to each one. We're willing to connect sewers in the area. We're willing to connect up with sewer, and we're not allowed to do so. It's a shallow lake that is or a shallow bay that is, you know, heavy algae, trying to deal with these kinds of things. And it was denied the proposal that the city supported, and now there will be several hundred. It's the land they finally gave up and sold the land, and several hundred. Units are proposed for something that could have solved, at least worked toward a better water quality in one bay. How do you deal with that? These are still voluntary, but this is an issue that we have to deal with in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Van Offlin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. Yeah, I think it leaves us, you know, voluntary is troubling to us. That's why we've said it's been a year. We need to move past voluntary, or, you know, that's the future of our lake shores and our waters depend on that. So we're, you know, awaiting DNR to tell us what their plan is here in about 30 days. So,
Mr. Chairman, have you considered the issue of the Metropolitan Services, the sewer, because the argument they come back with is that we have to have this development to pay for this infrastructure. And so, therefore, I mean, they haven't taken into consideration. I said, well, you've already got the pipes past hundreds of acres of parkland. If somebody wants to leave some open space and do this, you know, it means you can just go further if you wish, but not the unwillingness to protect this is we're having a challenge getting around that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think that is a problem, and I think as these few lake folks here will be testifying next, I mean, it's not just a metropolitan problem, you know, and that's where these you know, better rules at the state level for these state waters will help back up local governments in their decision making.
Okay, thank you so much. B. Hoffman.
Senator Chair, if we could, or excuse me, Mr. Chair, if we could exchange Ms. Hoffman down for John Hunt, her testimony works along with his, and move to Hallie Larson, would that?
Ms. Hoffman and Mr. Hunt want to come up together?
That would be fine.
Ms. Hoffman and Mr. Hunt.
I think they wanted to move to Hallie Larson first. Okay. Well.
Start. The gentleman with me is actually Jeff Broberg. He's president of Minnesota Trout Association. Good afternoon. My name is Bea Hoffman. I'm executive director of the Southeast Minnesota Water Resources Board. We're a 10-county joint powers board that was formed 20 years ago by a group of visionary county commissioners to support local water management activities at a regional level. And we do maintain a formal partnership with Winona State University Geoscience Department, and my office is located at their main campus in Winona. Because today I represent the interests of many people in southeastern Minnesota, I bring a different perspective than you heard today in much of the testimony, but it's nevertheless another very important aspect of shoreland protection. Our particular concern is the impact to the water quality of streams caused by the absence of riparian buffers in what's primarily an agricultural setting. First, just a little bit of background on the unique setting and circumstances of southeastern Minnesota, which is sometimes called the Blufflands region. The region of southeast Minnesota was surrounded, but it was left untouched by the last glacial period. And then the landscape that resulted is a highly erodible wind-blown plateau, silt plateau, and it's underlain by sedimentary rock, and it's deeply incised by river valleys. If you haven't been there, you should go. It's very beautiful. And as a result of this geologic history, southeastern Minnesota is a lake-poor but stream-rich region. We're blessed with 12,000 miles of river, over half of which are designated trout streams. And as such, we rely heavily on our streams to provide local recreational opportunities for our population. Our streams are a valuable economic resource as well. It's estimated, and these are the figures that I got, it's estimated the economic value of trout fishing statewide, of which a major portion occurs in southeastern Minnesota, is $30 million in sales and $18 million in income. Agriculture is the dominant land use in southeastern Minnesota, with a trend toward fewer and larger farms. The result is fewer acres of small grains and pasture and more acres of row crops. These trends result in conditions that lead to water quality impacts that include increased sedimentation, along with deposits of associated nutrients and chemicals, and less infiltration that leads to increased runoff, reduced base flows, and higher stream temperatures. Numerous studies have demonstrated that both the width and the continuity of undisturbed riparian buffer strips are positively related to stream corridor stability, water quality, and abundance of fish species, even in highly agricultural landscapes. However, it's estimated that on average, 40% of the stream miles in southeastern Minnesota that border row crop land are not protected by riparian buffers. This estimate does vary quite a bit from the western to the eastern part of the region. It's much flatter in the counties to the west, such as Steele and Maurer County. They have as much as 70% unprotected stream miles, compared to probably 20 to 30% in the eastern counties like Houston and Winona County, where there's less row cropping because of the steep wooded valleys. So how is this problem being addressed by counties? And I'm most familiar with counties because that's who I work with. As is often the case, counties try a carrot and a stick approach, at least in theory. One of the important efforts at providing incentives, the carrot, has been to target riparian buffers when they're promoting land set-aside programs. And while these programs have achieved some success, and we're talking about Conservation Reserve program and the Enhanced Conservation Reserve, their popularity is limited. Part of that is by the built-in restrictions, such as the cropping history requirements that restrict landowner eligibility. And some of the contracts seem like a very long commitment to the landowners, who are familiar with how the land and commodity prices do fluctuate. And currently, the payments that are too low to compete with the current commodity prices, in particular corn right now. But there's also a stick, and 9 out of the 10 southeastern counties have adopted the 1989 statewide standards for shoreland areas that require a 50-foot riparian buffer of permanent vegetation for parcels that have permitted agricultural land uses. However, the existence of the 50-foot buffer requirement is not well known among the public or even among elected officials, as we found out. A survey of county planning and zoning departments that we did in 2006 indicated that there's little or no enforcement of the ordinance provision, and there are virtually no triggers for compliance, such as a building permit application or a property transfer. And as to why it's not enforced, zoning officials most frequently mentioned lack of staff time and lack of public education as the barriers to compliance. Not every county in our region or in the state would have the interest or will to increase their level of activity related to the 50-foot buffer requirement, but some would. Therefore, we would like to suggest that the state explore the feasibility of the following voluntary and results-oriented activities to support counties in their efforts to increase compliance with the shoreland rules. First, we'd like to explore the possibility of replicating the 5-county alternative shoreland standards pilot in an area of the state where agriculture is the primary land use, and the focus would be on rivers. And they're inviting landowners and others as key participants. And there would be the possibility of developing strategies for compliance, looking at consistent enforcement, and there'd be a certain amount of publicity associated with that process, I think, that would be beneficial. Administration of the local shoreland ordinance is costly. The 2006 level of DNR shoreland grant funding for the counties in our region on average is a little over $3,000 per county. Therefore, we recommend increasing the level of DNR shoreland funding in the natural resource block grant to facilitate an increased level of county staff time devoted to public education and enforcement of the ordinance. But we do not suggest an across-the-board increase, but rather tying the level of increased funding to county activity or performance. County baselines could be established, and annual county annual audits of compliance could be conducted during the regular natural resource block grant reporting schedule. Another possibility would be to provide a financial incentive to counties who voluntarily develop a county shoreland management plan that would detail strategies for achieving compliance. We would also like to consider tying an increased level of shoreland funding for counties who demonstrate results in the implementation of their TMDL plans, where their watershed activities would include shoreland, more aggressive shoreland protection. And finally, we would like to promote means for increased awareness of riparian setback requirements as they relate to application of pesticides, manure, and chemical fertilizers. So I hope the committee will consider some of these proposals in the course of their discussion of shoreland protection, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Mr. Knopf, if a county has not implemented the 1989 rules, does that mean that they're out of compliance? Didn't you say that they're directed to by statute to implement those rules?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, they are supposed to adopt the model ordinance as a county ordinance. And if they don't, they get the Department of Natural Resources notifies them of that shortfall, and they are supposed to do it within 1 year of being notified that they are not in compliance, that their ordinance is not in compliance with the model ordinance. And if they don't do it within that year, then the DNR, as I mentioned earlier, has the authority to adopt it for them and charge them back for the cost. But I don't think they've ever done that. Mr. Lacasmo could speak to that directly, but I don't think it's ever been used.
And Ms. Hoffman, you're saying that there is one county in your area that has not.
Actually, all the counties have adopted it. One county was allowed to have a less of a restriction on the shoreland buffer. They have a 10-foot buffer instead of the 50-foot buffer. That's Houston County. And they made the argument that if farmers were not allowed to crop in the valleys, that they would go up the much steeper, erosive hillsides, and the effect would be that much worse. So they were allowed to have a less restrictive requirement.
Mr. Chairman, could I just clarify? I think what she's saying is that the department did approve that because of the ordinance. Their ordinance has to be approval, but they were allowed to go to that standard.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I agree with what you're saying, but also we need to work on big government because there's going to be no CRP acres anymore. President Bush and Johansson said absolutely not, and so how are we going to protect? Farmers would protect that. That's gone. That's not going to happen. So we need to work hard with our congressmen and senators to say, hey, you know, you got to put something back there if we're going to protect our shoreline. So just that's got to be part of it.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. If I could just ask one quick question about this Houston County variance for 10 feet along the streams. What's the effect? Has the effect of that been monitored? Is the 10-foot vegetation strip effective? Does it do what it's supposed to do? I mean, I can easily imagine in those really narrow valleys that the water will come racing down the hillsides and get right past a 10-foot buffer strip. So has the effect of that? I mean, I understand the argument because they're farming in very, very narrow canyons. And so, you know, it would be hard to take 50 feet of a valley floor. It's most of the valley floor in some cases. But what's the effect on the water? Have we monitored that?
I know that the studies have shown the 10.
Go ahead.
The studies have shown that 10 feet is not necessarily as effective as you need it to be, and there are also serious sedimentation problems in the Root River and the tributaries there, as well as in the Mississippi River.
So follow up. Is there something other than the vegetation strips, some other techniques or something, or maybe going to 20 feet as a compromise, something that can be done?
There are other types of tillage practices and contour strips that they can use also. It's actually the riparian buffer strips should be considered as part of a watershed-wide protection strategy.
All right, thank you. Mr. Broberg.
Mr. Chair, I have some maps I'd like to hand out here. Is there a position statement? Can someone help do that, perhaps? For the record, my name is Jeff Broberg. I'm And this too, please. Thank you.
Mr. Broberg, I would really appreciate it if you could keep it to 5 minutes.
I'm going to make this really short.
I appreciate it.
I know this has gone on. I'm the president of the Minnesota Trout Association. I wanted to talk to you today about the importance of shoreline standards in trout streams. What I'm passing out today is the trout stream map of southeastern Minnesota, just to give you an idea of our landscape in the context of the things that we were dealing with. I had intended to go through this page by page and talk about incidents of shoreland issues that have come up in all of these cases as we've dealt with a rather antiquated ordinance. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do that, but I would perhaps like to give an example of Senator Dibble's comment. In some areas, we had trails that were built within that 50-foot, what would have been a 50-foot buffer, within 10 feet, and large floods came along and washed them away. Those areas would not have been at risk if a 50-foot buffer had maintained. That had happened in the Houston area routinely. So it was a classic example, even for a public purpose, of having this variance that allowed building closer and then having an unintended consequence that cost a lot of money. I wanted to talk, if I had one thing to talk about, it would be the maps. And it's the fact that the current set of maps that we use for shoreland regulation are antiquated and not adequate for the job. If you go to the county officer auditors to look at the official protected water map, it's an old map with a colored pencil line of what's protected. In the age when we have the GIS capability to produce this product for trout streams in southeastern Minnesota, or at a scale that developers could use, we need adequate maps that show what the shoreland standards are. The other issue is local governments are uncomfortable dealing oftentimes with complicated DNR regulations. They don't have the training or the background. The map is the number one thing that makes them comfortable with their job. If there are definitions of what areas require certain setbacks and standards in a readable form, that helps me people be comfortable. I have one project. My business as a professional geologist is in development. I deal with developers, and we deal with shoreland regulations frequently. I've had cases where we've been delayed 3 and 4 months in a project because we can't get a definition of where we start measuring the setbacks because the DNR staff is overworked and not available to answer those questions. And so just the very notion of having a good set of maps with regulations that are up to date. The last issue I want to make is the standards that we have in place now are antiquated in language and practice. In the development community, we talk about new styles of development that had not been conceived of in the 1980s. And we have better ways to fit conservation in these areas that marry people's desire to be near the water along with the protections necessary to maintain them for future generations. That language is coming into place with the model ordinances that we're asking to be adopted statewide. Without that, we're suffering from old maps, people that can't or won't have the capacity to manage this, and people that don't know what's going on. We've created a lot of confusion. It's time to update these standards, so we'd really like to see a movement towards a new standard that puts these conservation principles into place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hallie Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in an effort to save time, the three speakers from the lakes will be up here together. If that's all right.
You get big points for that.
Great. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Hallie Larson, and I'm able to speak fast, so I will. I'm a member of the Lakes Melissa and Sally Improvement Association near Detroit Lakes in Becker County. The past few years, our association has been directly and indirectly involved in several developments on marginal or sensitive shorelands. Provisions in the Becker County Ordinance have consistently been inadequate to protect the remaining shoreland resources on our lakes from excessive development. I live on Lake Melissa, where about 5 years ago a development was proposed on land long considered unsuitable for development. It was the last undisturbed stretch of lakeshore in a highly developed lake. The developers submitted their plans to the county. These plans include moving a road, filling in wetlands, and funneling multiple families onto the lake through a tiny access lot. Fearing long-term negative effects on fish, wildlife, and ultimately the integrity of the lake, the Lakes Association petitioned for an environmental assessment worksheet. Then ensued years of effort by many lake residents and various agencies and thousands of dollars in private donations to educate the county commissioners as to what was responsible and permissible use of this land. Scores of revisions were submitted, some as threats and some as compromises. The personal attacks and exhausting debates were, in a word, bad for our community. The objectionable behavior of the developers was stimulated by the lack of statewide regulations governing and protecting this particular type of lake development, and because our county board was vulnerable to their various lobbying tactics. The makeup of our board changed twice during the time the development was proposed, with different results possible at any given time for that reason. The EAW review was invaluable to identify concerns, but it did not address several zoning issues, and the plan remained out of compliance with the ordinance. A major source of frustration for all was the fact the ordinance did not adequately cover such a situation, as development on marginal lands was not contemplated at the time they were written or revised. As a general development lake, there was no recognition that this strip needed special protection and was not suitable for development in the way the rest of the lake had been used. Appropriate standards regarding funneling, controlled access lots, and even calculation of appropriate lot size were challenged in this case. Given persistent developers and a county eager to accommodate, gaps in the ordinance were interpreted in favor of development at the expense of the environment, despite our efforts and those of the DNR and watershed, which were very helpful. Through litigation, a negotiated settlement was reached, but clearly legal challenges favor developers who have the financial means to continue until their goals are met, regardless of the environmental implications. This is not the only controversial lakeshore development we have been involved in, nor is it the only lawsuit against the county brought by developers or citizens. It's a constant struggle to get the county to understand the importance of the health of our lakes and to make decisions with the long-term interests of the land and the residents in mind. The very attributes that make our county attractive must be safeguarded, and citizens can't monitor every proposal. We're trying to focus our efforts on restore the shore education, and we know how difficult it is to reverse damage once it's already been done. Becker County needs to benefit from the work that was done in the North Central Lakes pilot project. The same reasons that prompted that effort exist on a statewide basis. Environmental minimum standards and protecting our state's resources must be removed from local politics. While Becker County has made some changes to its ordinance since the Sandy Beach plat was originally submitted, this was time-consuming, controversial, and threatened by competing interests such as increasing the tax base. We're dependent on the board to enforce them, and there have been indications by board members that they will be revisited, as some think they have already gone too far. Making the standards merely voluntary ignores the reality that many elected and appointed officials do not have adequate training or the time to devote to studying these issues. Further, outdated notions of development equals progress persist throughout the state. Protection of our environment cannot be discretionary, as there is a lack of expertise in environmental issues and extreme pressures and threats from developers. The alternative standards are an important step in recognizing the changing face of development in Lakes Country. The alternative standards would have addressed many of the problems with the proposed developments we are dealing with in Becker County. A patchwork of ordinances is clearly undesirable. The counties with the least restrictive ordinances would be targeted and vulnerable to unwise development. These resources are important to all of Minnesota. While updated rules won't altogether prevent county officials from approving deficient plans, it is the first step in protecting natural resources. It will set a consistent standard and fill the gaps in the current rules so developers and citizens can know what to expect. This will reduce the chances of controversy and misinterpretation, assist counties, and provide them with a firm basis to guide decision-making. Most importantly, it'll help protect sensitive lands and our valuable water resources. We hope statewide rules for Minnesota shorelands will be adopted as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Sullivan, and I live on Dead Lake. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share what's happened on our particular lake, a natural environment lake.
Where is that?
It is in central Otter Tail County. The last bit of information, the last two sheets, I believe, in your packet will contain information about that. And I will just go over some of those given the time. Dead Lake is a natural environment lake. As we had talked about earlier, it should have the most restrictive of shoreland ordinances pertaining to it. This lake is the 33rd largest lake in the state. It's 7,901 acres. It has 35 miles of shoreline and approximately 4 miles of island shoreline. 83%, it's a very shallow lake, 83% of this lake is 15 feet or less in depth. The average or the mean depth is 9.5. It has a large watershed of 102,000 acres, which means everything from those 102,000 acres will drain into Dead Lake. Dead Lake also flows into three other smaller lakes, into the Otter Tail River and then the Red River of the north, and goes up to Hudson Bay. So what happens in Dead Lake could affect a number of other bodies of water. In addition, Dead Lake, because of its shallow nature, its shallow shores, its submergent vegetation, it's been known for a major waterfowl lake. Its submergent vegetation is used by migratory waterfowl. There are also wild rice lakes, wild rice beds in the lake, and it was designated by the Native American tribes as one of the priority lakes. There's a wide variety of sport fishing done on Dead Lake. There's bass tournaments, there's swimming, and there's boating. There's a variety of recreation opportunities. It's 3.5 hours from the cities and about an hour and a half or so from Fargo-Moorhead. I've also talked about the increased population, 33% from 1900 to 2000 in our Dead Lake Township. I just wanted to give you kind of a framework of what this lake is like. Very shallow, natural environment. And this is one of these lakes that's being affected by developers that wouldn't have been done in the past. Almost 4 years ago, in December of 2002, a developer came and proposed 151 units and 125 boat slips in what's a conditional use permit, basically a PUD. The commercial aspect was going to be looked at a later date. In March, 4 months later, the county commissioners decided that an environmental impact statement was not needed, and they approved 138 units and 116 boat slips. The Dead Lake Association appealed this. And I should also let you know another aspect of Dead Lake is that there are probably, I counted, about six landowners that have 60 or more acres around this lake. So we realize that while we are very strong for pushing for improved ordinances, shoreline ordinances, it'll affect our development opportunities. It may limit it. It may eliminate it. But we feel that strongly about the ecology and the environment of Dead Lake. So Dead Lake Association appealed these decisions by Otter Tail County. We took the decision of no EIS to the district court and county court, the Court of Appeals, and they approved an EIS, which is the first one that's ever been done in Otter Tail County. Then we also took to the Minnesota Supreme Court the issue of approving a bonus density for cluster development without doing zoning first, basically. And the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed with us just where this should be taken next. In January, the county approved 94 units and 87 boat slips. And from the mitigations from the EIS, they took out 23 conditions that were presented to the developer. So it was approved significantly smaller. Also to let you know, there's an ad hoc committee that started in January of 2003 and has met every 2 weeks since then. We have raised over $312,000 for legal fees, appraisals, engineering firms, and the professional fees go on and on. We're very committed to this lake. But when it comes down to it, should it just be the lake associations that are committed to protecting the lakes? These are public waters, and we would really encourage greater protection of our number one resource in Minnesota. Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Former Senator Gene Waldorf.
Yeah.
Welcome to the game. And we did misspell your name on the agenda. We apologize.
That's all right.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Gene Waldorf, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm very happy to be here.
Did you represent?
What area?
Yes.
Senator Anderson's area.
Okay.
Who I think is on the committee.
Yeah, she's empty chair here.
I think she followed me in office in St. Paul, east side and north side of St. Paul.
Thank you.
I currently live in Gray Eagle, Minnesota, which is at the south end of Todd County. I also live on a lake called Big Birch Lake, which is a fairly large lake, 2,200 acres, and is divided evenly between Sturgis and Todd County. I currently serve as the president of the Big Birch Lake Association, which has been working for some time to restore the water quality on Big Birch Lake, which had been deteriorating. In 2005, our Lake Association was recognized as Lake Association of the Year for an ongoing effort to improve the lake water quality. In the past 9 years, we had achieved a 4-foot improvement in average water clarity on the lake. As I indicated, the lake is divided almost evenly between Stearns and Todd County. It is apparent when you are on the lake that the zoning rules are different for those two jurisdictions. There are more boathouses and modifications of the shoreline on the Todd County side than on the Stearns County side. At times, the counties have been asked to work together to resolve the differences in how they dealt with zoning issues, but to date, no progress has been made. Another example of differences between the counties, Stearns County amended its zoning ordinance some time ago to prohibit marina and docking facilities on the lake for second and third tier developments. In October of 2005, almost a year and a half ago, we asked the Todd County Zoning Administrator to consider the same amendment for Todd County. We are still waiting for action on that proposal with no explanation for the delay. All lakes in Minnesota are experiencing increasing development pressure, and certainly Big Birch Lake is one of them. There are obviously differing views on the good or bad of lakeshore development, but unfortunately, I think local governments seldom have the staff and money to adequately research issues before they are forced to make individual decisions. When the DNR and other state agencies set rules, mandatory rules, for lakeshore, and other land use decisions, those rules become the standard for local governments to follow. As evidence that I have two zoning ordinances here, one of Todd County, another one of Gray Eagle Township, and these two ordinances contain all the mandatory DNR rules. That's the standard that they follow, and they enforce them, so that works pretty well. I'm not aware of any non-mandatory standards that are included in those ordinances, though. And I'm not aware of any efforts to utilize those. That process works well because when the local zoning authority doesn't follow the agency rules, which are incorporated in their own ordinances, there's a basis on which to challenge their decisions. It has been some time, as you know, since the DNR rules have been updated, and the changes which are occurring need attention to prevent further degradation of our lakes and rivers. I ask on behalf of everyone working to protect our natural resources to request a review and updating of the mandatory DNR rules for Lakeshore. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for the witnesses? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Waldorf, it's good to see you back at the Capitol and for a committee again. I don't have a specific question about the testimony you gave today, but I remember the last time you were here, it was on an ATV issue, I believe, and some rather bad effects on roads and environment from ATV use. I was wondering if you could give us an update if that has improved, gotten worse, or stayed the same. What do you see out around Big Birch Lake?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
we're talking about shoreline.
Mr. Chairman, this does have an effect on water quality.
I'll make this quick, Mr. Chairman. Senator Fredrickson, around Big Birch Lake, around our counties, nothing has changed with respect to the county regulations ATV use, and as you probably are aware, that there has been very little change in the state rules, at least with respect to county or local government regulations on ATVs. We still have runoff problems, but I think in our area there's been a reduction in the use of those machines, at least from appearances. And so we're a little less concerned today than we were at the time I appeared last. But runoff is the problem. Our property owners have addressed our water clarity issue by privately engaging in contracts with farmers in the area to buffer along a major creek that enters our lake and reduce the runoff from ag land. And that has been just a tremendous difference in affecting the water quality. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Waldorf, were those farmers compensated for? Pardon? Were the farmers paid? Were they compensated?
Yes. Our Lake Association reimburses them $250 an acre for buffer strips, and they're very happy to partake in it. Not only because they get reimbursed, which they should, but also because they care about the water quality in the lake as well.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Waldorf, one final question on that. Is that coupled with a RIM payment or CRP payment, or is that entirely just your lake
association? They refused, Mr. Chairman, Senator Franks, and the farmers in the area, for whatever reason, refused the CRP program, partly because we would have paid them considerably less than what we pay them.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all the witnesses. We'll take the two county commissioners, Catherine McLinn and Brian Napted. Welcome to the committee. We appreciate you coming down here all this way.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Brian Napted. I'm Macon County Commissioner.
Thank you. Who would like to go first?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Catherine McLinn, Itasca County Commissioner. I was elected in 2002 to fill Senator Saxog's term when he was elected to the Senate. And I was reelected in 2004, and I'm here to take a quote from my campaign brochure, which is simply, "Working together, public officials and citizens can do great things." So I'm here to ask you, and I look forward to working with you as well as the citizens who have brought me up to speed on these issues, so we can together do great things. Exactly 3 years ago, I testified before Governor Pawlenty's Clean Water Cabinet requesting their endorsement of the North Central Lakes Project, which it was and is a citizen-driven collaborative among five counties. And I want to emphasize, it was the citizens working with public agencies that brought the North Central Lakes Project to where it is now 3 years later. At that time, I said that the proposal would be an opportunity for counties to work together and share resources. At that time, 3 years ago, I said there is a critical need for shared information and mutual support for local officials as they attempt to make land use decisions. Especially, we needed support for our Planning Commission members and us, the County Board. At that time, I said there would be benefits to the counties and the state. Better informed decision makers, and I'm a product of being better informed thanks to Paula West, Henry, and many others in the room, including the DNR. Better informed decision makers will have the knowledge and the support to set policy that would have a positive impact on our economy and our quality of life. As you probably know, in northern Minnesota, we depend on timber and tourism. Good land use decisions are critical for the survival of resorts, retail stores that sell hunting equipment, lodging and dining establishments, just to name a few businesses that would benefit from this proposed project. At that time, I said good decisions by local units of government would mean more efficient use of taxpayer dollars. Well-written local zoning ordinances would set clear guidelines for building and development. Consistently applied criteria by local planning commission members could result in less confusion and less resistance from landowners. developers and contractors, and this is something that I noticed Hallie reported, developers and contractors could then efficiently plan their projects when local ordinances would be consistent with state regulations. This might mean fewer court challenges and less wasted staff time. I said then, and I say even now, more critically, citizens I hear from are demanding that government protect their private investments by not allowing the degradation of our forests and our lakes. Citizens are asking for policy that protects public investments, our public parks, and that protects public health and welfare. A constituent sent me a quote that I presented to the governor's Clean Water Cabinet. It was, "In the end, our society will be defined not only by what we create, but by what we refuse to destroy." And Bob Schroeder, who is currently the chair of the cabinet, correctly identified the author of that quote. The Clean Water endorsed our cabinet and sent us forth with good wishes. 3 years have passed. One of the goals of the North Central Lakes Project, there were many. We were involved in education, conservation easements. One of the goals was to update the shoreland standards. I served on the committee along with representatives from resorts, contractors, lake associations, and public agencies. The meetings were, and I emphasize, facilitated. They were made easy by the DNR. They provide the science and the research, as well as the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Throughout the process, we were the ones making the decisions, and we worked very hard to keep all the players at the table, especially when we dealt with some of the challenging aspects of planned unit developments. We were able to keep everyone at the table, including representatives from the counties, by agreeing that the counties could maintain local control. We agreed and we designated our work as voluntary, with the intent that any public or private entity or individual landowner could take the ideas that we developed and adopt them in whole or in part. And that's where we are today. Many public agencies and private landowners are considering the elements and the alternative standards and are recognizing the solid science and the creative thought that went into them. On the maps that you see, Itasca County is listed actually in yellow, but the concepts in the shoreland standards actually came in part from our ordinance. Our ordinance is actually more protective than the minimum standards. So some of the ideas that the five-county project used came from our ordinance. So we actually should be in green. In addition, we did adopt some of the PUD language just this last summer when we revised our ordinance. But many, many citizens throughout the county recognize that much more must be done if we expect to maintain the high quality of our natural resources. And there does continue, as was reported by the lakeshore owners, a real struggle by decision makers, specifically planning commission members and county boards, to make those critical decisions that will maintain that high quality. It's tough for us, and we can't do it by ourselves. I have found that establishing policy to sustain our state's resources requires leadership. You've got to take the bull by the horns. It takes foresight. You've got to be able to see into the future. And it takes cooperation between the public and the private sectors. In Itasca County, we had great leadership provided to us by the DNR, by the Soil and Water Conservation District, by the University of Minnesota Extension, by the Itasca Economic Development Council, those who are responsible for bringing economic development into our county. They worked with us on the shoreland standard ideas, and many of our citizens who were on the shoreland standard were part of the Itasca Economic Development Council Lakes Management Jobs, Lakes 2020 Management Action Team. I'm here today to urge you to give attention to the rulemaking process that would allow more public exposure to the valuable tools that we've developed. As I understand it, the rulemaking process would allow many people to participate in an open discussion, and it would allow naysayers, those who aren't sold on the idea, to come to the table and learn more about the science. I know the Association of Minnesota Counties has apparently taken a position opposed to making the shoreland standards mandatory. I agree, it can't be done with one fell swoop so that the public thinks they're getting something shoved down their throats. That's not going to work. We county board members aren't the center of the universe, but we like to think we are. So anything that makes it look like we are part of the process, which I commend the North Central Lakes Project for being, would be something we can work with you on. We are doing it at the county level. Even this week, we're going to be updating our comprehensive land use plan starting Wednesday, and we're following that with revising again our shoreland ordinance. It's been revised in 2003, 2005, and 2006 because we're trying to keep up. Many citizens have participated. Many will participate further, and we will be considering adopting more elements of the alternative shoreland standards. We ask you to do likewise on the state level simply because it helps us. The more publicity that people hear about on the state level, from other counties, from citizens asking, the more it helps us to see that there is a general direction that the citizens of the state would like us to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Naptad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will make my comments very brief, as I know we're running over time here. Again, my name is Brian Napstead. I'm from Aiken County. I was a member of the North Central Advisory Committee that met for about a year and a half in Brainerd, as were three other county commissioners and 30-some advisors, many of whom you've had presentations here today. I think you've seen a great deal of commitment to our water resources in Minnesota, not only just the five-county pilot area, but in other areas, as was pointed out, that there's ordinances being put in place. I would like to point out that the five counties that were involved in this advisory process all have comprehensive shoreland ordinances in place already. In fact, the document that the document that we developed was based on Chapter 6120 of DNR rules, along with the various comprehensive shoreline ordinances that the various counties have. So I would like to simply point out that we are very committed to shoreland protection and to protecting those assets. At the same time, I would like to point out that when the committee convened, we were given a very clear set of instructions, and that was to develop an alternative set of standards. The term that was used most frequently was tools in the toolbox. Provide us with a group of tools that counties can pick and choose to augment their present ordinances, or if they don't have a shoreland ordinance in place, allow them to go ahead and adopt this ordinance or the portions of it that they feel are applicable. And that was a very agreeable task. It did take quite a while to come up with the alternative ordinance, but in the end, and I think it was December of 2005, we did agree that this was the best product this group or this body could develop, and we moved it forward. Since that point in time, the direction that's been given is that there was going to be about a year's worth of public education, and then counties would look towards adopting some or portions of that policy. There seems to have been a little bit change in direction here lately with the calling to make the alternative standards mandatory. And I would be here to throw a great deal of support in with the DNR's letter that these standards were developed as alternative. Within these five counties, you can adopt those portions that you seem to find most beneficial. Aiken County, which is shown in white there, which probably has some of the most restrictive shoreline standards in the state. It's interesting, we're shown as white. We are looking at beginning public hearings public meetings this spring to adopt portions of that alternative ordinance. Now, one of the frustrations I think that's come out is that although those rules were passed in December of 2005, not enough has happened since then. I would suggest that chronologically, you know, a number of months, 14 months or so, have passed. But when you're in these northern counties, probably two-thirds of our population is absent from our county right now. We did our public education, along with the DNR that did a lot of work on this last summer. They did a great deal of public education to those people that were within our county, the shoreland owners that are in our county last summer. This summer, we begin to hold public meetings to talk about the resort component, the PUD component, the multi-classification component, and the special protection districts. We have those meetings scheduled for May. We simply have to wait until the people are back in town. Now, we don't have to stop the process of developing and modifying ordinances just to wait for those people to come back. However, it is our experience that if we do something when they are absent, we miss the public education component of the ordinance development process. We lose some integrity by virtue of the fact that there's accusations that we passed ordinances in the dark of the night when they were gone. And what we simply want to do is be inclusive, similar to the Shoreland Ordinance Development Committee. It was an attempt to develop a very inclusive advisory committee. We intend to do the same thing on a county basis. We want to include all of our residents when we debate and determine what portions of that alternative ordinance to adopt. So I just reiterate, I am very supportive of the letter that came forth from the DNR indicating that this was originated as an alternative ordinance. It was never developed as a package that you had to adopt or not adopt. It was tools in the toolbox. AMC has taken the position that they support the DNR. Aiken County also supports the DNR's position on that. And we are moving forward to making that happen. I guess just as a side comment, I do find it interesting that many of the counties, I think it was mentioned Dead Lake is up, it's up around Alexandria, I think, but a number of counties, the southeast portion that doesn't have shoreline ordinances in place right now for the rivers, the rules, DNR has Chapter 6120 of the shoreline regulations in place statewide. Everybody is governed by a set of rules. Aiken County and Itasca County and others have taken those, and we already have a much more comprehensive set, and perhaps these other counties need to take a look at 6120 or perhaps adopting the alternative standards. That is their choice. That was the way this alternative standard was developed, and I would urge you to keep the alternative shorelands as alternative, as tools in the toolkit for any or all counties to adopt. And if there is a drive to move forward to a statewide policy or a statewide mandatory shoreline zone, that is to say a revisiting of Chapter 6120, I would not only be happy to participate on that committee, I would participate on that committee. Aiken County would be happy to be involved. But if we're instructed that this is a new set of mandatory rules, I do believe the end result would be different than what we drafted as an alternative set of rules. Thank you.
Mr. Knapp said, you said Aiken County was part of this North Lakes discussion?
North Central Lakes Pilot Project.
Okay. So why hasn't Aiken County adopted or even considering adoption of any of the alternative standards till now?
Well, first of all, in many cases, we're already more restrictive than the alternative standards. So, in fact, if you look at the matrix that was developed during the process of this time, Chapter 6120 was laid out as state rule, and then there was a column, there was a spreadsheet. Cass, Aiken, Itasca, Crow Wing, and Hubbard all had their various rules. In all instances, not all, in many instances, the county regulations for a particular thing was more restrictive than the state. For example, right now, the state allows 25% impervious coverage. Aiken County's rule today in our shoreland ordinance is 15% building coverage. That's more restrictive than you will find at the state level. We passed that 15% coverage in 2004. So one of the reasons we haven't moved forward right away in adopting all the various portions of the alternatives is we're already more restrictive. That would be a relaxing of the rules if we were to adopt the whole thing in some cases. The other is public input. We want to make sure that the people are involved in this process.
I want to thank everyone for being here and contributing to this discussion. We really appreciate it. I think this has been extremely informative discussion, and we appreciate everyone's contributions. Meeting's adjourned.
No, I have to stay here anyway.
You can keep
this. Committee's in here at 3 o'clock.